found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:59 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
Good evening. This is Lane Ponce. I will be your host this evening for Labor Radio. I have three guests with me this evening. Two people are with Indivisible, and they will explain more about that. That would be Megan Cleland.
Yes.
And Jeff Kidder.
Good evening.
And we also have author and former co-host Susan Stoner. So we'll start out with what's going on with Indivisible and an explanation of exactly what is Indivisible. Megan, why don't you take it?
Sure. There are a lot of things going on. Indivisible started after the 2016 election. It was just a Google document that started about kind of how to get involved in advocacy with your local representatives. And it was written by congressional staffers who saw the Tea Party kind of use this particular strategy to kind of engage with their members of Congress. And from there, it blew up until it's about 6,000 groups nationwide, anywhere from five people. You can be a person, you can be an Indivisible group of one, to our group where is Indivisible Oregon specifically. We're not technically a chapter of the national. We just kind of like started on January 1st in one of the founders' living rooms as a way to kind of resist what was happening or we thought was gonna happen in the Trump administration as far as legislation goes. And so we have about 10,000, is that right, Jeff?
It depends somewhere? On how you count.
Yeah. But yeah.
And that's statewide?
Statewide. So what we started out doing was writing daily calls to action that were Oregon specific with scripts for our two senators and our five members of U.S. House and on issues that were kind of happening at the moment and how you could kind of call what the issue was about and so on. And then that has kind of morphed into weekly Resist Trump Tuesday events at the senator's office in Portland. Every other week we alternate Wyden and Merkley. And then now we're getting into, we are heavily involved in the ACA repeal against it. And just kind of calling and educating people on what it was, how you could call your representative and how you can kind of keep your health care. And now, that was a year and a half ago. We've been doing that for a while. And just in the last couple of months, we've started to really get involved in the midterm elections, mainly in Washington 3, which is just to the north, and then in OR2, which is Greg Wallen's district, basically the east of the Cascades.
Small area
the size of Missouri.
Bigger than any state on the eastern seaboard.
Yes. It's right in the middle. The district itself, I think, is the seventh largest in the country. And so that's kind of where we've been putting our energy, as well as, writing actions to try to stop the Kavanaugh nomination. We're kind of in crisis mode, as well as trying to ramp up for midterm elections, because we, I think, as a group, have recognized for several months that this is going to be the most important midterm and most consequential midterm election in our lifetime. There's so much on the line.
Well, let me ask you about the call to action. Tell me how that's put together and how people can find it.
Sure. So we have a policy team that gets together every Friday and talks about kind of what's coming up on the calendar, what are the major issues, what kind of the energy is behind, and write things every day, put it on our Facebook account, Indivisible_OR, and our website, indivisibleor.org /actions. And every day we have a new action, not only with background about what the issue is, but a specific script for every member of our federal delegation. So you will have three people that represent you no matter where you live on the federal level. You have two senators, Merkley and Wyden. All Oregonians have those. And then you have a specific district U.S. Member of your house. So we have scripts for all that, where your congressperson stands on that particular issue, and how you can either call and thank them and ask them to do more if you feel like they can go farther, or you can call and ask them to please vote no, or please consider voting no, or all sorts of stuff. So,
right. So one of the central premises of Indivisible as a movement is the most influence a citizen can have is to connect with their representatives, because they're there to represent you. And so they want to hear from you. Calling into other states doesn't do nearly as much because they don't represent you. And we often get the question of, well, why should I call my representative if I live, say, here in Portland when they agree with me? And we found that it's very helpful for them to know that we've got their back, that we're paying attention, that we know about the issue, and that helps them be even more bold and take to the national stage, get on Rachel Maddow, get on, you know, Senator Merkley traveling down to Texas to expose this whole families belong together situation. You know, without them knowing that their constituents are really in support of what they're doing, it's hard for them to put their neck out and take that risk.
Well, Susan, let me ask Susan, you were unfamiliar with this group. Do you have any direct questions about what they're doing or how you could get involved?
Oh, well,
put her on the spot here.
I was wondering who's Greg Walden's opponent in the midterm election?
So, yeah, we just had our primary on the 15th, in May 15th. His opponent is Jamie McLeod Skinner. She is, if there was someone, I say this a lot, genetically engineered to be able to kind of to win in that district, not only win, but also represent the constituents' issues the best. She is an amazing candidate. And Jeff is actually knows a little bit more.
And where's she from and where does she live and all that?
Well, she went to high school in Ashland. She has an amazing biography that's brought her around the country and the world. But she's come back to Oregon. Right now she lives in Bend, although she spends a lot of her time in her little teardrop travel trailer traveling to all 20 counties that are in Oregon's District 2 to actually talk to potential voters. And she really likes to bring up that even when you're talking to someone who politically might be in a different party, an independent, we have common values. Decency is bipartisan, is a thing that she likes to say. And so she tries to bring things back to family and community. She talks a lot about physical infrastructure and social infrastructure, and those are things that all Oregonians can get on board with. And she has an amazing ability to communicate with people in Eastern Oregon without kind of activating the tribal defenses, you know, mm-hmm. that what to one person might be sustainability, to another person might be stewardship, but you can still talk about the important matters without getting into some of the, like.
Do you know what her stand is on universal health care or free education? I guess the Justice Democrat, Bernie Sanders.
Well, she has a really fantastic website, jamiefororegon.com, and she has a whole value section where you can really drill into all of her individual things. I'm not a spokesperson for the campaign. But I have been doing a lot of canvassing for Jamie, and that's been fantastic, talking to, knocking on doors in Hood River and the Dalles, which are a beautiful drive here from Portland, and talking to people about what their concerns are, and letting them know about Jamie, especially when there's events coming up. It's great. We just had a phone bank here in town last Thursday, where we were calling people to let them know that she was going to be in Wallowa County Inviting them to come and get a chance to meet her. Because that's the thing is, she's taking more of like Ron Wyden's approach of actually showing up, whereas Greg Walden has been kind of notorious for not making himself available to his constituents. He hasn't been holding town halls. And
do you know what her position is on healthcare? And
so I will say, having heard her speak and having listened to some political podcasts, she was on something called Two Broads Talking Politics, and she did kind of a great breakdown of the way that she thinks about things, the way she communicates. And I also think that it's important to remember that Portlanders and people who live in the city are facing a very different set of issues than someone in rural Oregon, which listening to her kind of talk about that has been eye-opening. There, when she talks about access to healthcare, that's something that can a lot of Portlanders would be like, well, I want more than access. But in rural Oregon, access is the difference between life and death, and that there are police stations that you have to go through Idaho to get to. Talking about broadband and getting the agricultural needs with satellites and all sorts of stuff that I was not aware of. But she did talk about affordable health care. And one of the things she said was that when she talks about it, everyone can kind of agree that people should have health care. They should have access to health care. It should be affordable health care. And one of the ways we can get there is single payer, but it is not the only solution. And I think that she has been really great about talking about the end and not necessarily the means in a very narrow way. And that's something I thought was really refreshing to hear, that that it's not necessarily one buzzword idea, but let's talk about how we get to the end.
Right. And sometimes in the urban context, we think of access as talk about healthcare access as being sort of a dodge. But if you're living out in rural Oregon, you know, if you break your hip and the nearest healthcare is 2 or 3 hours away, access matters, right? You need to actually be able to get there.
Yeah. And I think the access for healthcare in rural areas in the United States is also even more about the fact that doctors cannot afford to make a living out there. I keep thinking of Doc Martin, where in universal health care in Europe, they pay to have medical personnel that are close at hand. Mm-hmm. And you have a lot of hospitals in the United States that are also folding because they just can't sustain themselves. So I think that access is almost, you're always going to have, I mean, I don't know how much you've been out in rural Oregon, but I know that at least the Southeast, it's a long ways between houses.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So they're always going to have an issue of distance, but I think it's even more, is there even a health
right.
professional out there for them?
Well, and especially since Greg Walden was the main architect of the ACA repeal, where the district that he represents would have been the largest loss of insurance because Oregon expanded Medicaid. It's a unique situation, having looked at several members of Congress's voting records over the last year and a half, 2 years, and then kind of looking into Walden and then also hearing the needs from someone who was talking about it on a real practical level. I don't know if I have ever, that I have in the last year and a half, 2 years, seen someone who so actively works against his own constituents' interests, especially with like net neutrality. Broadband access to that area is the way that agricultural communities are gonna grow with the economy. The fact that he's trying to repeal the ACA, which funds community health centers and gives everyone access. A lot of farmers, you have pre-existing conditions, all of that stuff is something that you don't necessarily think about. And then recognizing that the person who is supposed to represent the constituents' issues is actively voting against them and writing legislation that actively works against them. It's just been kind of strange to watch, but also really refreshing that Jamie has kind of come in, and she's a challenger in an area that they haven't had one in several years, a lot of times because people think it's unwinnable. But I like to point out that Greg Ron Wyden won that district in 2016. And so there are the votes for a more progressive candidate. It's just about activating people.
Right. And even more recently with the special election in January with Measure 101, just looking within Congressional District 2, that measure won in the district.
So Measure 101 addressed what?
Healthcare. It basically, so Measure 101, on top of it being unnecessary to have the vote, but also really confusing by saying, if you vote yes on 101, we get to keep the funding that we already had planned. And that can sometimes kill a measure. And the fact that they were so organized and aware and active to get out for that vote, a special election in January, late January, understand kind of the way you have to vote, because that can be really disconcerting. It was the only thing on the ballot, and it passed in District 2. And that was kind of eye-opening, I think, for everyone, that like there are people there, and they just kind of need to recognize their power, and that it does, these voting affects your life.
Mm-hmm. Right, and when I've talked to people on the doors, that's one thing that's come up, is sometimes people are a little, they seem discouraged, like, oh, well, you know, do we really even have a chance?
Yes.
And part of that comes from they don't realize how many of their neighbors I've just talked to their neighbors that are very excited about Jamie and then are worried that, you know, they're the only person in town who thinks that way, right? And so when you talk to person after person, it's like, you guys should all get together and talk.
Right. And if you had broadband access, that would be easier, which we're working on. Yeah.
So you said, closer to home, I suspect, you said Washington District 3. Who is that, and what is that going? What's that race about?
Right, so that's the other Jamie.
Yeah.
We can be confused.
Right, so there's in southern Washington, there's Congressional District 3 with Jamie Herrera Butler. And
Republican.
She's a Republican, and that was one of the most recent additions to the swing left list of potentially flippable House districts that they've managed since early after the election of Donald Trump. And she tries to present herself as a moderate, but if you look at her voting record, that doesn't really pan out. And she is another one of these politicians that doesn't make herself available to her constituents. She holds these sort of sham town halls by phone, and kind of there are a lot of complaints about how they're managed. And Washington State has a very late primary. Their ballots are out in the field right now, so people are voting right now in their primary. The ballots need to be postmarked by August 7th.
It's an open primary, too.
It's an open primary, and it's a jungle primary. So
yeah, what do you mean by jungle primary?
Right, so that means that the top two people, no matter the party, go on to the general election. So that got a little bit of news in the California primaries, but this isn't one of those situations. There's one strong Republican in the field for the congressional race, and there's quite a field of Democrats running. And so the kind of exciting question is, you know, which of the Democrats is going to emerge as the contender in the general election? And we'll know that very soon.
So the Oregon Indivisible People kind of crossed over the river and helped them out.
Yeah, so kind of how it worked is, like Jeff said, Swing Left was a group that organized mainly just online after the election to raise money for swing districts that they deemed as the most competitive. Since that day, it has expanded because as the movement has kind of evolved and more people started running for office, that list grew. And there was an election in Washington 3, like, was it a special election? That basically put it on the Washington 3 on the map for swing left. And so what they've been doing over the past at least year have been gathering resources to help people, activists and volunteers, reach out to the voters in those districts. So kind of like get out the vote tools. And what we did, because Indivisible Oregon is not a legal entity, we don't raise money, we're just like a group of volunteers who really care, and we do this stuff. And we have been using kind of Swing Left's infrastructure to help in Washington 3 to canvas and things like that. And then they'll raise money specifically for that whoever is the challenger that emerges in that district after the August 7th
right.
primary.
So that gives people an opportunity to donate money, even if they aren't in the district, to whoever the eventual Democratic nominee is going to be. And that really helps whoever that person is start off their campaign, you know, because
with
that
a
gives
plan.
You with yeah. a plan and knowing how many people they might be able to hire. And so for especially for people who are concerned but outside of the districts, you kind of have two different strategies you can think about. You can be focus on the general election and say, okay, whoever is going to be running against the person that I don't want to win, I'm going to want to support, you know, now. Then your other option is even before the primary to get involved, you know, pick a candidate that you really like and help them with either fundraising or canvassing or phone banking. And so we've seen a mixture of strategies in the sort of grassroots movements.
Okay. Well, you're listening to KBOO 90.7, and we have three guests here this evening. We have Megan Cleland and Jeff Kidder, who are representing, more or less, Indivisible Oregon with other outreach throughout the country. You're connected with other...
Oh, yes, we know everyone.
You know everyone. And our other guest is Susan Stoner, and she's been helping out with launching questions to these guys. Thank you, Susan. She also was a former host here.
Irrepressible.
Yes.
I think you were here the first time that Smitha and I were here.
Maybe.
I think
yeah.
so. Yeah.
You were looking familiar to me also.
Yeah. And Susan has just recently finished a book in a series that she's developed over a number of years, and she tells me it's her seventh book. So, Susan, let me know a little bit more about your new book.
Okay. Well, before I do that, I just kind of want to explain what the series is about. It came about as I was a union lawyer, and what I learned, and I have always liked history, and I, as a lawyer, the people that I work for, I realized didn't know their own history and didn't realize that in some ways they were repeating or fighting to keep what their ancestors had actually done. So that's kind of the basis, what got me started with this. And unlike that old saw, you know, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it, mine is more, if you don't know history, you don't know how to repeat it or what should be repeated or that you can repeat it. And there's, so all of the books basically celebrate ordinary people who make changes. And change the paradigm of the culture. And my belief is that the first progressive revolution in the early 1900s is actually something that we should really look at because those folks had a lot of challenges and even harder lives than we do now. And so in the last book, which is called Slow Burn, I look at firefighters in Portland and what they endured in order to save the city from burning was a time of many, many, many fires, a lot of them because there was no building codes, because they didn't know how to use electricity. And so we had these firefighters who lived in abysmal conditions, earned terrible wages, like $24 a month. They were earning less than even bus drivers, I think, at the time.
Now, this was like in 1902?
This book takes place in 1903, in November of 1903, when it's raining a lot. and so... which makes it a good read for the summer, this summer, where it's so darn hot. But anyway, but there's more to it, and that is that I had read a little blurb. I always go to the old-time newspapers, and there was a one paragraph that said the city council's voted to either brick or gravel Milwaukee Avenue and Powell Boulevard because the National Board of Fire Insurance underwriters said either you make those passable in the rain or we're going to not insure any structure in that area. And I go, holy heavens, who is this? What organization is this? And I actually don't like insurance companies, but I have to say this is one time when the financial interests of the capitalists and the financial and the health and safety of the public coalesced to actually change what American cities were like. And so that organization is also discussed. And then the final part and piece of this, and it, people who read it say it works perfectly, but it doesn't sound like it, and that is that at this time there was a real conflict in the black community across the nation between Booker T. Washington's sort of hat in hand, we've got to demonstrate to the white folk that we deserve to be treated like equal human beings. And then there was W.E.B. Du Bois, who said, hey, the fact we exist means we deserve to be treated like equal human beings. And not only that, we shouldn't try to be white people, we should try to be ourselves and celebrate our uniqueness because we have contributed so much to this culture and this country. And so that is also part of that. And it played out in Portland. I do a lot of historical research and a lot of original source documents, things that are written at the time. And
so where would you go to look for that kind of thing?
Oregon Historical Society, Portland Archives, the library, the university. It's out there. Not as much as I wish there was. The aspect of the black community, one of the things that happened was there was two newspapers. There was 1,200 black folks in Portland, and of those, you know, a number were kids, but they still managed to have two newspapers and support two newspapers, and they represented those two opposing views. And that was in response to post-Reconstruction. You had the rise of racism that was like coming up out of the South and parts of the Midwest, and it actually came into, you know, there's a lot of talk about Oregon used to have the Ku Klux Klan. Well, that was a buildup from the late 1800s through the early 1900s, finally gave rise to that racist organization.
So you incorporate all that into this story about this, firefighters.
Yes, this slim volume of 232 pages.
In your last, in several of your books, at the very end, you go through and talk about what's factual and what you've borrowed and expanded a little. Did you do that in this one?
Yes, and you know, it, all that sounds really dry, but what this is...
Not to me. I feel like that sounds very exciting.
It's a fast-paced mystery. It's an easy... People say these are easy reads, and you don't really... I hopefully get caught up in the story, and it's only afterward you learn that, oh my God, I know all this stuff about this area. I never knew the history. And this time... 53 historical notes, which is the most I've ever done.
Oh, goodness.
And that, I could have done so many more, but yes, I
do. Historical notes, I find those very interesting, always.
Yeah, and a lot of characters are based on real characters. This one, I sort of celebrate a guy named David Campbell. He was the fire chief in Portland. They just had every June 26th, they have a memorial, the firefighters have a memorial at 18th and Burnside. There's a little wedge with a little picture of him and a bell. I don't know if you've ever noticed it.
Not, no.
It's outside the stadium. I went to it this. It was very moving. They ring the bell. They have people. They give, you know, honor firefighters who've risked their lives. And it's, anyway, David Campbell was an incredible public servant. And when he died, he was killed in a fire, Standard Oil fire, or Union Oil fire, actually. He went into the burning building to make sure it was going to be safe for his workers, and it wasn't. But he was beloved so much so that they didn't form a union while he was alive. As soon as he died, they did, but he fought so hard for him. But he was an amazing guy, and so he's in here as a character.
Very nice. Well, you know, our talk is coming to an end. Thank you, Susan. And I understand you'll be at Powell's Hawthorne August 30th.
Yes, 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock at the Powell's Bookstore on Hawthorne. So I'll be there.
Great.
And you guys are invited, too. So one more time, let me have you tell us how to get in contact with Indivisible here in Portland.
Yeah, so you can go on Facebook. We have a bunch of events that range from canvassing in the Dalles and Hood River to canvassing in Washington, in the Vancouver area. We have phone banks, which we really need help with. A lot of people have not been contacted for several years and just get cleaning the voter rolls and making sure that we have accurate information as we run up to the election. So you can find those on our website, indivisibleor.org/midterms, or you can go to the front page and there's an annoying pop-up I put there intentionally, so so you'll see it and you just click on the button. It's also on our Facebook page, facebook.com/indivisible_OR. All our events are there. We have a community calendar. If you have anything coming up, feel free to put it on there. We will approve it. Get involved. Go to thelastweekend.org is the national push for those last 4 days before the election. We need everyone.
Okay. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed your company for our half an hour for Labor Radio. And tune in to Labor Radio every Tuesday from 6 o'clock to 6:30.
Monday?
Monday. Yes, every Monday. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is 50. We are celebrating our birthday with a big street fair and party on August 11th from noon to 10 p.m. here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. We'll be broadcasting live bands all day and an open house celebrating 50 years of KBOO. There will be a reunion from 2 to 5 during the street party for folks looking to see KBOO volunteers from other eras. So save the date, Saturday, August 11th, to celebrate 50 years of KBOO with your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Baby,